Okay.
So, good morning. Today we have with us Dr. Graham, and I'm going to start conducting this interview. So, one of the first questions that we had come up with was, how has your daily routine changed since the start of the COVID outbreak?
I guess my background is I'm a pediatric ICU doc, and then I also run a outpatient program for children with home ventilation needs and chronic respiratory failure. So I'd say, actually, my daily routine has changed in both realms. Probably easiest to start with the outpatients. We're dealing with presumably high-risk group in the sense that these are all individuals, children, young adults with chronic respiratory needs, although we haven't seen that necessarily their COVID vulnerabilities are any greater than any other group, but certainly vigilance in terms of just a background need. So fielding lots of calls and trying to send out regular updates to our patient panel and in terms of precautions and anticipatory guidance. Also just additional resources. Our program in general did a lot of home visits. That's really sort of the basis of our program, is to sort of go into the home and minimize some of the stressors on the family and to get a better sense of the home care provision and optimizing setup for them. There, we obviously curtailed that a lot, partially because families are justifiably wanting to limit people into the home, but we're also trying to protect our staff and otherwise and not, we're really trying to minimize any potential spread. So we've actually transitioned almost entirely to telemedicine. Now, we've been doing telemedicine for some time, just on a much more limited basis. We actually have been doing it for almost 10 years. With various platforms, but obviously expanded it greatly now, so doing that almost every day. And then we are still doing very limited home visits for children who are transitioning home on new supports, because that's sort of their most vulnerable time, and the risk of complications and need for rehospitalization. Sort of risk-benefit of us going into the home and doing limited interventions there probably made sense and was in favor of continuing to, see them in their home care setting, at least for the setup and initial transition. Really, a lot of the care of the home patients has been somewhat reassurance, helping them navigate challenges, because there have been a few equipment shortages, and probably of greatest impact is the lack of home care services, so nursing and PCAs that would otherwise provide routine assistance to individuals and families. Part of that, again, is just lack of availability. Some of it's self-restriction based on families. Some of it's just because there's just not a huge workforce, and anyone who's quarantining, it's been challenging to fill hours. And then I've actually had a couple of older patients who had to fire their PCAs because a couple of them felt that all of this was a hoax, even as recently as a week or two ago, and so weren't going to abide by any sort of contact precautions or otherwise. So the families or the individuals that I work with just said they had to fire them, which is probably entirely justified. So, our outpatient services has evolved dramatically and has changed, and we'll have to see what this impacts longer term. Everyone's mental health, I think, is being challenged. My ICU time is different in the sense that, and I've been on a couple of weeks here and there, as a freestanding children's hospital and the only one in New England, we haven't seen a lot of COVID cases. We've definitely had some COVID positive patients. We've had a couple of sick COVID patients, but nothing dramatic. I think overall we've only had a few dozen positives, and most of those were either asymptomatic or minimally symptomatic and came in for other reasons, not respiratory related. So the direct impact hasn't been so great. We've obviously received a lot of pediatric patients from other hospitals in the region, and they have, the adult or combined hospitals, the smaller pediatric services, have appropriated all their pediatric beds for adult patients. So as a result, they've cut back on their pediatric services and are feeding everything to our hospital, which I think from a resource utilization perspective makes a lot of sense. And so the patients that we've had have been sick and need to be there. The total volume is actually down because we're not doing anything elective. There are no elective surgeries. There's no sort of elective medical trials or otherwise. And so, the volume within the hospital itself, we have plenty of capacity, but the patients that are there certainly need to be there. And what we're also seeing is that there's somewhat of a delay sometimes in presentation, that people are so reticent to come in to the hospital due to concern for exposure that they're coming in a little sicker than they might have otherwise. And it may be that they also just don't have ready access to their, local providers because a lot of primary carers and otherwise have curtailed their hours. So, the general milieu of the hospital, everyone's sort of trying to make the best of it. I think it's nice to be able to come into the hospital and see people relative to sitting at home. It is actually nice to have some interpersonal interaction that's not on the web or on a telephone. That aspect's good. But I think there is this sort of undercurrent of anxiety and when we're going to do things that are high-risk procedures and potential exposures and things like that, you sort of get a sense that everyone's anxious. Not that anything contentious, but I think people are just, just worried, but worried for themselves, and then actually it's not probably worried for their extended family. But that's the day-to-day busy. I think everyone is inundated with emails, either COVID-related or indirectly COVID-related, talking to colleagues, it's a struggle. There are certain things that have blossomed in terms of additional workload, other things that have had to be put on hold. It's definitely changed sort of the day-to-day practice. So.
Yeah, it's understandable. And you had kind of hinted at this already about the emotional and the mental component of all this. And I was wondering if there's any kind of institutional support system for how to deal with this, or if there's kind of formed anything between colleagues. If you could speak to that a little bit.
Yeah. So, our department has set up, one of my colleagues in anesthesia, she set up virtual happy hours. I have to say, I don't know how many people have attended those. I've sort of opted out, partially because, spending so much time on a screen already, I'm not sure that I'm, that was enough. I'd rather go outside on a walk if possible. I think, the hospital has sort of, obviously made sure that people know that there's additional supports through an ombudsperson or counselors and what have you. Definitely made those efforts. And then, I think individual people are trying to help out. And one that is, while the hospital has tried to limit staffing presence, only sort of although most people are considered essential at the hospital, they've made sure that there's chaplaincy support around and that there's social work support around. And I think, obviously they've been there to check in on patients and families, but you also get the sense that they're just touching base with staff as well. There's no one who's not affected by this, I think, is one of the keys. I think there's sort of that appreciation. And, the other thing that actually, I guess it's helped morale, is that, there has been food everywhere. And, various restaurants have donated food, and other people have sent in food. And actually, families who are being cared for have ordered in food for staff. And, it is actually nice. I think people really appreciate it, is that, you can, when they're not at the bedside, that they can break away and there's something there. And, it's one less thing you have to do to sort of sometimes prep and bring food in for lunch and dinner or what have you if you're there. So it actually is, something to be said for that. And I think, again, at the hospital, just being able to socialize a little bit is helpful, because I think the challenge is once you get home, you're much more isolated. So in some respects, being able to go into work, I think, is a reprieve for those who have that opportunity.
Yeah. No, that actually sounds really nice, that it's kind of banded together a community in a way.
Yeah.
I have one question that I thought of. You mentioned, that it's limited to essential personnel and no elective procedures. How has that affected clinical trials?
Yeah, that's a huge problem. There are clinical trials that are ongoing. What they've tried to do is limit the, researchers or research staff that are coming in. So it's sort of, if you happen to be in the hospital already, they ask for those individuals to cover things on the trials that they may or may not have already done. I've actually been charged to do some exams that I wouldn't necessarily routinely do, although I'm qualified to do, just because I didn't want additional staff coming in. And the administrative staff, the support staff, and the clinical trial support are doing everything they can to do it remotely. And then, currently various forms that need to be completed, and CRS and everything else, everything's being done remotely. So that aspect has continued, although I don't think that we really have done any start-up new trials unless it's directly COVID-related. I know that several folks at the hospital are engaged in those, but I think people have tried to make the most of trials that are ongoing and keep them going, although it has been challenging. The elective surgeries are interesting because the question comes up, what's elective versus what's not? And it's the interpretation of that has been left up to, the individual providers have tried to determine and work with families around that, and then it goes to a sort of broader panel that is not, supposed to be a little agnostic impartial, and from a surgical or anesthetic perspective, is this elective and is it worth the risk? So that volume is significantly down, but everyone's taking those precautions. But the implications long-term are huge, because literally there are going to be thousands and thousands of backlogged cases, orthopedics, and you name it, that are going to need to be caught up. In the month when things sort of open back up again. So people, while they may have some departments may have a little bit of a lighter workload now, are going to be anticipating an onslaught going forward. But your other question about research is interesting. I was actually on service with a colleague of mine about 2-3 weeks ago who runs a big basic science lab, and he's closed. I mean, his lab has been closed now, I think, for about 6 weeks. He's continued to pay his postdocs and research assistants through his grants, but there's no productivity because they can't actually be in the lab. So the implications are actually huge in that respect. In terms of, a lot of that time will never be made up, and productivity off of a time-limited and monetary-limited grant is going to be challenging. There'll be other repercussions as we
Yeah, I was thinking about that because I know my team is doing everything remotely, and it's hard. It's not as productive as when we're there in person.
No. It's difficult. And I mean, and, you know, I think a lot of people continue to have, you know, lab meetings or research team meetings. But, you know, and people, I think, are catching up on writing and doing the other things that they can do. But in terms of new studies or, you know, either experiments in the basic science lab or getting new clinical trials up and running, it's just going to be challenging. I mean, I think people are trying to make the best of it and what have you, but it'll be a while. And then certainly, you know, if you're trying to recruit patients that aren't immediately around you, that's almost impossible at this point.
Wow. I guess my next question would be about, you know, training before this. Was there any training prior to the outbreak to prepare everyone for this, or was it just kind of on the fly when this happened, additional training being provided?
So we had, there were a select group of us several years ago when we had the Ebola outbreak in Africa, and there were anticipated cases coming to, you know, throughout the world. Several of us had gotten training for Ebola, but it was much more confined. And there were probably a couple of dozen people trained at the hospital. I think, you know, everyone, you know, is sort of, I guess, informally trained in precautions, some more than others. Obviously, the folks who are in the OR do a lot in terms of scrubbing and downing and gloving, and then we do as any procedures in the ICU. But this is now for every patient and every person and every encounter. So, you know, mechanistically, it's not challenging. I think it's everyone is getting up to speed. Some of the challenges I think we are encountering are less about what do I need to do, as opposed to how is this changing on a day-to-day basis based on our understanding and also the limitations in personal protective equipment. Which patients do we need to wear masks for? Which ones do we have to wear N95 masks for? There are a variety of sort of, it does change regularly. So I think that's one of the difficulties that people are having in terms of sort of, you know, staying up to speed. We've done a lot of simulation around high-risk procedures, intubations, extubations, other things. And transferring of patients, and then people who haven't been able to participate in the simulations have done, there have been videos, although to an extent those need to be updated regularly as new nuances emerge. So it is difficult when you're looking at training everyone in the hospital, which is really what needs to be done, and from every discipline, because it has changed some things that, you know, each person's roles, whether it's respiratory therapy or nursing or, you know, the physician staff, honestly, even child life, still, you know, the hospital's been really good about making sure that child life, their representation as an essential service, because the kids who are there still need all the supports that they can, and they are limiting families in terms of numbers of people coming in, just to limit potential exposure. So while there are people here, I think it's been challenging for families to sort of navigate that as well.
I saw that there's like limits on, I think, one family member or something about that per patient. Is there anything like the hospital has done to kind of make that easier for families? Or
yeah, I mean, while they have, I think the official statement is one, it's not uncommon, especially in the ICU, to see, you know, if it's a two-parent family to have both parents. But, you know, oftentimes there's allowances for siblings to come in and everything else, an extended family in the ICU setting. That's not been the case, but they are limiting it to, like, just sort of, you know, the two parents or two guardians or something like that. And I can only one stay overnight, typically, unless it's under extreme circumstances. So, the challenge has been, I think, for some of the families is if they come in and their child is COVID positive, or if they're even as a rule out, that the family is also has to remain in that room, that they're actually quarantined within the room with the patient on precautions. Early on in the course when it was taking, 5 to 7 days to get testing back, parents were stuck in a room with their child for that period of time, assuming that they still needed to be hospitalized. So I think that was challenging for some, although the best of it as well. Now it's, with the test that we have in-house, the turnaround is much more rapid, so it's actually made it easier on everyone in terms of working with families, but also liberating some of the kids as they test negative. We're able to sort of resume some aspects of routine care.
Awesome. And then I guess my final question, because this is something that everyone's been talking about, is the shortage of personal protection equipment and ventilators and how that's affected, I guess, normal operations in the hospital, because I know a lot of healthcare workers have been very concerned with that.
Yeah, so the ventilators actually is an easy thing. We have not had an issue with shortage of ventilators, although I think the fear of that has been significant. So talking to colleagues in Seattle, they actually... they received from the national storage, sort of the stockpile of ventilators, they received about 500 and then sent 400 back and never used the 100 that they kept, which is good. I mean, but it's nice to have that, to have had that capacity. They wound up sending those 400 into back to New York City, actually. And I'm not sure what the utilization was there. In Boston, sort of the greater New England area, we really haven't had too much of an issue, except that, the hospitals, as you sort of, go farther and farther rooms outside from Boston to 128 to then 495 and then north and west, the community hospitals and some of the outlying hospitals have filled up, and as a result, sent more patients into the cities. Mass General is probably the most heavily burdened with COVID patients. We've actually sent from children several ventilators. I don't know how many we've sent over now to them to utilize and sort of on loan. But they've never reached capacity. They still have lots of surge capacity because we've been able to adapt ventilators from the operating rooms and otherwise, and so that really hasn't been so much of an issue. I think it was definitely a concern because we were sort of waiting to see what the trajectory of the sort of cases were and otherwise, but actually not been too much of an issue in terms of ventilators. On the back side of this, though, it is interesting. There is question as we enter the recovery phase for a lot of patients, there may become some capacity issues because sort of the downstream effect in terms of rehab and general respiratory convalescence may put more of a strain on the system. As new cases come in, people are coming off ventilators as quickly. So it will be interesting to sort of see what happens in the coming weeks, but currently that's not so much of an issue. The personal protective equipment is interesting because actually prior to this, every year we get fitted for an N95 mask, and it's a one use and throw away. And traditionally, like if you have a patient with TB or something else that requires an N95 mask, a variety of viral things. You would literally go in, see the patient, wear an N95, and then throw it away. That is clearly not the case now. I think each hospital has sort of devised its own sort of method for conserving. So We now have, each person has their N95 mask and a little box that looks like, you know, like you get at a fast food box for a hamburger or something like that. And so you keep it in that, and then you label it at the end of the day, and it can be sterilized with this ultraviolet light process, and you can reuse it for 5 sequential days or longer if you don't have any, if you haven't used it. So yeah, there's definitely you know, a concern and concerted effort to conserve those things. We have plenty of gowns. You know, gloves has not been an issue, but you can see how that might be over long term. I think there's lots of concern in the community, as I said, sort of as I overlap with the outpatient. You know, there's really no allowance for home care PPE, so nurses going into the home have to provide their own, and families who have people who are at risk, it's the same thing. And, you know, talking to colleagues who are at some rehabs and long-term care facilities, they've had significant difficulty getting any PPE, at least beyond sort of standard, you know, contact stuff, but certainly nothing that's meant to be intended for something like this. So, yeah, it's, you know, I think we have the privilege of being at a large academic institution that has resources and reserves, and can either rapidly access them or, you know, sort of implement sort of other sort of, you know, regulations and what have you to have, sort of help people navigate that. But that's, I think, again, that's just reflecting the fact that we have sort of are in a privileged position. I think the community hospitals are having much more difficulty, and then once you get sort of beyond that, it's been very challenging.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me this morning.
I have talked to a couple of colleagues who went and one in particular was volunteering in New York City at the hospital, and she said it's the most collaborative she has ever seen hospitals. I mean, you know, we work in, medicine is not always the most collaborative effort, certainly between hospitals and sometimes even within, and you do get the sense that everyone is trying to help the other, which is great, and we certainly are seeing that in New England as we look at consolidation of resources and otherwise. So it is helping with some things. So hopefully some of those will be sustained afterwards. But yeah, we'll see. There's a lot more to come, I think.